Welcome to the Northbound Wealth Podcast. All opinions expressed by me, my co-hosts, or my guests are solely our own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Northbound Wealth Management. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and is not intended as personalized recommendations or fiduciary advice. It is not intended to provide and should not be relied upon for any investment, accounting, legal, and tax advice or as a solicitation to offer or buy any securities. Clients of Northbound Wealth Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. Hello, everybody. This is April 15th, 2024. Welcome to the Northbound Wealth Podcast with your host, Brent Foster. And I just want to say thanks for tuning in. We've got a good show for you. And we're going to dive back in here after being gone for a little bit due to tax season. We got busy. And now we're going to be back. We're going to be giving you some market updates, market insights, and some information on stocks and certain companies that are reporting earnings. Your favorites, obviously, the Mag 7, as well as a few others here probably in the coming weeks. So stay tuned to the podcast to hear what we have to say about those companies, those indexes, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, the Dow Jones, and kind of where things are headed. So let's dive in. We've got weekly market insights, stocks, or let's see, we've got stocks startled by inflation and conflict. Obviously, the escalation between Israel and Iran is not good. And that will kind of bring to the forefront geopolitical risk as well as market risks in those different economies. And so it's just an escalation of what's been going on. Anyway, inflation. Stocks fell last week as investors sorted through conflicting inflation reports and assessed geopolitical tensions. That's the headline on Wednesday. This is last week. The March Consumer Price Index, or CPI, report rattled markets, revealing that inflation accelerated slightly more than expected. Bond yields rose and stocks retreated in response as investors feared the news could influence the Fed's rate decision. Higher for longer is the phrase, right? Everybody now is understanding that a little bit more. The 10-year Treasury yield had its highest intraday jump in 3 years. 3 years. Markets rallied Thursday as investors were encouraged by the PPI report, which measures inflation at the producer level. Unlike CPI, PPI rose less than expected, which sparked a tech-focused rally. Markets opened lower on Friday, that's last week again, as investors wrestled with the conflicting inflation reports. Fears of an escalating Middle East conflict also weighed on stocks during the week. Concerns about potential weekend event led investors to end the week in a risk-off position. So on the blog, on my website, www.northboundwealth.com, I've got Y charts. You can check it out. Weekly market insights, major index returns, the summary of the Dow, the MSCI EAFE, which is the overseas international markets, NASDAQ composite, which is tech heavy. And then you've got the S&P 500 and as well as the 10-year Treasury note and review on it. Well, let's take a look at the Dow. Year to date, the Dow is up 1.32%. The MSCI is up 3.35%. The NASDAQ is up 7.97%. And the S&P 500 is up 7.86% year to date. The 10-year Treasury note just a month ago was at 4.16. 3 months ago was at 3.96. And then 3.41 a year ago. Guess what it's at now? It's at 4.5%. And that's quite a change. And actually, as we look out into the near future, it looks like the 10-year note's likely to go up. And then the major indexes are likely to go down. So we're just in a standard, ordinary, anticipated, highly anticipated, and long overdue correction. So it's nothing to freak out about or worry about. But it is something to be noting and watching and paying attention to. And thank you, Y Charts. This date is through April 13, 2024. Or, yes, 2024. So, minutes from the March Fed meeting published Wednesday showed officials concern that inflation wasn't slowing down quickly enough towards the Fed's 2% target. But despite sticky inflation, they reiterated that rate cuts were still on the table for this year. The start of Q1 earnings season reinforced inflation concerns as several lending money center banks, despite many beating expectations, forecasted lower growth for the remainder of 2024 due partly to inflation and higher than expected rates. It kind of crimps net interest margin and the spreads that the banks make. So on Friday, the University of Michigan survey showed consumer sentiment fell last month. Some concluded that the survey confirmed that consumers have been saying what they've been saying for months, that inflation is still in their everyday lives and is a big factor. So this week, key economic data, retail sales, business inventories, housing market index, Empire State Manufacturing Index, Tuesday, housing starts and permits, industrial production, Wednesday, EIA, petroleum status reports, Treasury International Capital, Beige Book, 20-year Treasury bond auction, Thursday, jobless claims, existing home sales, EIA, natural gas report, and the Philadelphia Fed Manufacturing Index. And I do like to get this data from Investors Business Daily, the Econo Day economic calendar. And so take note of that and look it up. This week, companies reporting earnings. Monday would be Goldman Sachs, then Charles Schwab. Tuesday, United Health, Johnson & Johnson, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley. Wednesday, Abbott Labs, Prologis, CSX Corp. Thursday, Netflix, Elevance Health, Marsh, that's a grocery market chain, the Blackstone Group, Procter & Gamble on Friday, and American Express on Friday. So there you go. All right, tax tip of the week. The IRS has made it easier to file your taxes. Forms now contain electronic options, meaning tax professionals can conduct remote transactions. To allow your tax professional to use electronic signature option, you must fill out and submit a Form 2848, Power of Attorney and Declaration of Representative. This form constitutes a written authorization appointing tax professionals to represent taxpayers before the IRS. This includes performing certain acts on the taxpayer's behalf. These acts can encompass providing an e-signature. And again, this information is not intended to be a specific individualized tax advice. We suggest that you discuss your specific tax issues with a qualified tax professional. And this tip was adapted from IRS.gov. Before we go on to the next segment, I was having a conversation with Thomas Townsend. He's my financial analyst intern. And we were talking about the mortgage market and what's interesting here. So the Fed is in this higher for longer camp, and that has implications in the stock market and the bond market. And it also affects the housing market in a great way, given that housing values are up, supply is low, or, you know, there's not enough supply, not enough homes out there. And sellers aren't willing to sell. Buyers aren't willing to buy and pay the higher mortgage costs of having a mortgage. And it's actually really difficult for buyers to generate the cash down for a down payment on a house and then afford the mortgage payment when interest rates are cruising in the sevens for a 30-year fixed. So something that I was talking to him about, I was alive in the 80s and 90s, and then the early aughts, so the 2000s, and then I remember the Great Recession and going through that. But something that I brought to his attention was I recall back in like 2004 that interest rates were like 5 or 6%. And I said, I just wonder about the housing market. I think people are going to get used to higher interest rates on mortgages. I think that the Fed is trying to almost create a new normal in the space where people accept a higher rate. I mean, the days of 0% interest rates are long gone, or low twos, threes, and fours on a 30-year fix are long gone. I don't think we're ever going to see those again. It might be a long time before we do. We might have to have another crisis, and then the Fed drops rates to zero to see those days again. But I just asked him on the fly the other day to share with me. I just said, hey, well, what about 1987? What was the 30-year interest rate on a mortgage in 1987? And then we walked through multiple years, and I'll go over that with you. So he said he pulled up his data and analytics, and it said the 30-year fixed rate in 1987 was 10.4%. In 1997, it was 7.57%. Okay. So that was a bull market in the stock market is in the 90s. And then we had 2000 and then dot-com bubble in 2000, 2001, guess what the interest rate was on a 30-year fixed? 7%. Okay, so let's fast forward another 4 years in 2005. And of course, in 2004, it was 5.88%. In 2005, 5.93%. I was in Santa Barbara, California about that time and starting work after college. And I remember many people looking to buy homes during that time. In 2007, when I was acquiring my first home, I interest rates were 6.4%. Okay. And then we had the great financial crisis, the GFC. 30-year fixed rate was 5.38% in 2009. But get this, in 2012, it dropped to 3.88%. That's what, you know, in 2009 and 10, when a quantitative easing happened and interest rates went to zero to try to stimulate things and save the economy. That's when there was a huge benefit in it, and it actually helped an 11-year bull market happen. So in 2019, fast forward many years, 4.13 was the 30-year fixed. So still that whole generation of people from basically 2010 to 2019 experienced exceptionally low fixed rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage. And then we had COVID, right, in 2020 and then in 2024. So we've basically seen interest rates go up from 2021, or actually, we'll see here, 2021 to 2022, the Fed raised rates, the stock market declined, things tightened up, quantitative tightening was happening, and it effectively worked. Now we have a mortgage rate back up to 7.125% on a 30-year fix. That's the other day. So I'm looking at this saying, gosh, we went through a season from 1987 where rates were 10% on a mortgage, and then 97 where it was 7.57. And basically it stayed between the upper fives and sevens all the way till the great financial crisis. And then they declined. And now we're back up to those pre-great financial crisis levels, pre-COVID levels. So it's interesting. I think maybe the Fed's going to go higher for longer, going to keep rates high. Everyone has to adjust. The market has to adjust and it's able to deal with it. But the housing market hasn't happened yet. It hasn't loosened up. So who knows? Maybe we'll get a quarter basis point rate cut, and then that'll be one for the entire year. Instead of coming into this year, coming into 2024, many banks were like, the Fed's going to lower rates three times. We're going to see 75 basis points to 1% declines in interest rates and all this other stuff. And I actually don't think that's going to happen. We'll see, but long and variable lags. The Fed isn't in any rush to move rates, and people are going to move on and they're going to have to accept probably higher rates. And so are businesses. Everyone's going to have to adjust, because after all, the Fed does want to have more levers to pull in the next great recession or in the next financial crisis. They want to keep rates higher. And even though they're telling us they're fighting inflation by doing so, which, yeah, that's true. But at the same time, a 2% target, we'll see about that. We'll see. It's going to take time for all of that to happen, given how much quantitative easing happened post-COVID. It was insane what they did there. Way too much money in the system. Anyway, that's just food for thought. Good notes to take. Stay tuned for the next section. We'll keep moving through. Give your children the gift of financial literacy. As a parent, you are all well aware of your responsibility in helping your children grow up happy and healthy. Once they enter their teen years, the pressure can build to impart more of your wisdom. One area you shouldn't overlook is how they handle money or how to handle money. Helping your children develop basic financial skills is critical to preparing them for the decisions that they may eventually make as they age. Laying a solid foundation for their formative years can help shape their lasting relationships with money. Money habits may not be taught in schools. So if you think that they will learn all they need to know in school, that's not the case. Although more states are realizing the importance of teaching students about money, as the end of 2023, only 30 states require a course in personal finance to graduate. A 2022 survey of the states by the numbers, 25 states require students to take an economic course to graduate. 30 states require to take a course in personal finance to graduate. So that's an increase of 5 more states. It's progress, but I mean, shouldn't it be all 50 states? 0 is the number, or the change in the number of the states that require students to take an economic course to graduate. So there's absolutely no requirement to do so. That 0 number jumped up to 9 are states that require students to take a course in personal finance to graduate since 2020. This is asinine to me. It's unbelievable that this is the state of the United States of America culturally as it relates to finance. I honestly think it's on purpose. I think it's to keep people uninformed and uneducated, and it's only to propagate a system that can benefit off of that. It's ridiculous. I'm a big advocate for financial education, and that a lot of that should be taught in the homes, right? Should be parents. But if parents can't manage their own money, then they're not going to communicate that to their kids very effectively, I don't think. Hopefully this is a beginning of a change in the United States. This data is from the Council of Economic Education as of February of 2024. So as parents, you are one of the most significant influences on money habits, and your children will see you practicing financial concepts in real life situations. Yet one study shows that only 28% of parents speak to their children about money. Think of school as a reinforcement of the concepts you may have already been discussing. How old should kids be when they start learning about money? It's a good question. Warren Buffett once said, "Parents' biggest mistake when teaching children about money is waiting too long to start." One study from the University of Cambridge found that kids can already grasp basic money concepts between the ages of 3 and 4. By age 7, basic concepts relating to future financial behaviors have typically started to develop. Starting early can help, but so is keeping the ongoing financial education age appropriate. Between the ages of 11 and 13, children may be ready to learn about the benefits and drawbacks of like credit and debt, as well as interest, budgeting, and identity theft. Older teens will be able to grasp the concepts of long-term investing, good versus bad debt, and taxes. Based on your child's age, there may be ways to introduce financial literacy concepts in a comfortable, easy to grasp, non-threatening way. Once they have a basic understanding, you may be able to take actionable steps to teach them more advanced lessons about money. Money basics for younger children. So here are some ideas for helping to create a baseline of financial knowledge for your younger children. Number one, involve children in family conversations about budgeting, saving, and careful spending. Hearing you problem solve can equip them to handle issues better when they're older. Number two, consider giving your children an age-appropriate allowance tied to predetermined household chores to help them value money, what goes into earning it, and how to begin balancing their savings and spending. Number three, make learning a game by using iconic board games like Monopoly and Life. You may be surprised at how much these old school games teach skills such as investing, saving, and preparation, also real estate acquisition. There are also online games that teach similar lessons. Number four, let your children witness actual cash transactions as it may help teach kids the value of different denominations of bills and coins and the importance of seeing how much money is needed for what they want to buy. This is something my wife and I implement with our girls. It's been a lot of fun seeing them grab these concepts and really internalize them. And they are 5 and 7 years old. It's amazing. 5 and 7. Get started now. Get started early. Money lessons and actions for teens. So when your children enter their teen years, they should start to show basic understanding of personal finance. This is the time when they may be getting part-time jobs, thinking about major purchases like a car, and preparing to go away to college. Lessons from getting a job. There are reasons for teens to get jobs beyond money. work teaches responsibility, builds character, encourages teamwork, and gives teens a sense of what they might want to do for a career. Earning money from work can be a more powerful concept than allowances, reinforcing how time, labor, and experience matter. They might think twice about spending money that they've worked hard to earn. So teaching the difference between needs and wants is another concept. Deferred gratification can be an essential lesson for impulsive teenagers. Your teen may believe they need the latest smartphone or video game. While your teen may have some good reasons to call something a need, stay firm when you talk to them. For example, they may need a cell phone, but want the latest and greatest. If they have the money left over after caring for their needs, consider letting them splurge on some wants. This might help reinforce budgeting and debt management in the future. Asking them to track expenses and start a budget. Your teen might learn valuable insights by tracking their spending and setting up a simple budget. Some may be surprised to see where their money goes. There are apps designed to help your teen track expenses. Once they understand how much they spend, your teen can create a simple budget, perhaps using a money management app. Understanding Venmo. If you do not have Venmo, consider opening an account and learning how the app works. Then teach your teen, or maybe they'll teach you. Venmo and other apps are how finances are often handled in this digital age, such as dividing the bill at a restaurant or splitting a rideshare. In 2023, Venmo introduced the Venmo Teen account, allowing parents to open a Venmo account for their teenagers between the ages of 13 and 17 so they can send and receive money. Each Venmo teen account is connected to and managed by a parent's personal Venmo account, so the parents can monitor transactions, manage privacy settings, and send money to their teen. Venmo is owned by PayPal. Consider a Roth IRA to help your teen learn about saving and investing. If your teen has earned income, they may be able to qualify for a Roth IRA. The contribution limit to a Roth is a maximum of $7,000 in 2024 and cannot exceed their earnings. Suppose you are a small business owner looking for ways to provide additional benefits for your children who work for the company. In that case, you can include a Roth IRA as part of their compensation, a strategy that can potentially benefit both the children and the business. Roth IRA contributions are phased out for taxpayers and adjusted gross incomes above certain amounts. To qualify for the tax-free, penalty-free withdrawal of earnings, Roth IRA distributions must meet a five-year holding requirement or occur after the age of 59 and a half. Tax-free and penalty-free withdrawals can also be taken under certain circumstances, such as the owner's death. The original Roth owner is not required to take minimum annual withdrawals. Also with Roths, Roth IRAs now under certain tax codes are and can be used for a couple of things that are notable. One, I think the first $10,000 can be used towards a down payment as a first-time home buyer without penalties. So they can take money out and use that money to contribute towards a down payment on a home. Also, student loan payments are qualified withdrawals as well without penalty. So keep that in mind if there needs to be a student loan that needs to be repaid. I think up to 10 grand also on that one. The gift that keeps on giving. Parents who actively teach their children about money can help them build a foundation for future success. Children's money habits often begin to form early, and they watch how you handle your finances. By prioritizing teaching financial skills to your teenagers, you may contribute to their academic achievements, career successes, and overall well-being. By helping lay a solid foundation, you're helping your child prepare for life's inevitable financial challenges. If you haven't already, start now. They might thank you later. As financial professionals, we are here to help. Please contact us if you have any questions on anything that I just covered in this piece. I hope you learned something from it, and we're going to go on to the next segment. Stay tuned. Create a strategy to protect your wealth with potential estate tax changes looming. At the end of 2025, portions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, TCJA, are set to expire. Many changes will come with the sunsetting of many rules, including the possibility that federal, state, and gift tax exemption levels will revert to pre-TCJA levels. What's changing? Currently, you are subject to federal estate tax only if your individual estate is worth more than $13,610,000 for individuals or $27,220,000 for married couples. These levels are more than double than those of pre-TCJA estate exemptions, which were back in the past used to be $5.49 million for individuals and $10.98 million for married couples. If the estate exemptions revert to pre-TCJA levels when portions of the TCJ Act expire at the end of 2025, more individuals and couples may be subject to federal estate tax when they pass away. If managing taxes on your estate is a priority, it may be time to start thinking ahead about your overall estate strategy. Some basics about gift and estate taxes from the IRS are: how are gift and estate taxes figured? The IRS letter explains it here. The gift and estate tax provisions apply to a unified rate schedule to a person's cumulative taxable gifts and taxable estate to arrive at a net tentative tax. Any tax due is determined after applying a credit based on an applicable exclusion amount. A key component of this exclusion is the basic exclusion amount, which is called BEA. The credit is first applied against the gift tax as taxable gifts are made. To the extent that any credit remains at death, it is applied against the estate tax. How did the tax reform law change gift and estate taxes? Good question. The tax reform law doubled the BEA for tax years 2018 through 2025 and adjusted the BEA for inflation. Under the tax reform law, this increase is only temporary. Thus, in 2026, the BEA is due to revert to its pre-2018 level adjusted for inflation. The projected inflation adjustments vary, but from a preparation standpoint, using the $5.49 million for individuals and $10.98 million for married couples is one approach. Estate strategies to lower taxes going forward. Assuming that exemptions will fall back to where they were, it may be time to look at or think about how these lower levels might impact your estate and existing financial strategy. Consider making adjustments to reflect the new limits. Gifting. So for 2024, the annual gift tax exclusion allows you to give up to $18,000 per year or up to $36,000 if you're married and filing jointly per recipient without it counting towards your lifetime gift tax exemption or affecting your estate tax. Additionally, there is no limit to the number of people that can give or that you can gift to in a single year. This means that you could gift $18,000 or $36,000 as a married couple to each of your children, each of your grandchildren, or any other individual without reducing your available exemption. This is a yearly use it or lose it allowance. So if you don't do it, you lose it. Amounts over that per recipient limit will count towards your lifetime gift and estate tax exclusion. Furthermore, any income or appreciation after a gift is given will no longer be part of your estate. Gifting removes any future value from your taxable estate. Also, keep in mind that you can pay educational expenses without them counting towards annual exclusions or lifetime limits if they are paid directly to institutions. Benefits of gifting during your lifetime. I'm a big advocate for that. You get to see the benefit of it, except for, you know, if you're dead, you don't get to see the benefit of it. There are several potential benefits of gifting money to your heirs during your lifetime, even if it counts against your exemption. Number one, managing estate tax. By gifting assets while you're still alive, you can manage the size of your taxable estate, potentially lowering your estate tax liability. Number two, gain control over asset distribution. You can choose who receives your assets and in what amounts. Number three, help heirs sooner. Your heirs can benefit from gifted assets sooner rather than later, which may help them buy a home, start a business, or pay for education. And then number four, minimize potential conflict. So gifting during your lifetime can help manage potential conflict among your heirs after your death. I've seen that, unfortunately. It's sad, really. Tax advantages of gifting. In addition to potential estate tax savings, there may be also some tax advantages to gifting during your lifetime. One of those being gifting assets that have appreciated. If you gift an asset that is appreciated in value, the recipient may receive it on a stepped-up basis. This means their basis in the asset would be the fair market value at the time the gift was given rather than the original cost basis. This may help them manage capital gains taxes if they eventually sell the asset. And then also the second part of that is using your unified credit. Your lifetime gift and estate tax exemptions are combined into a single unified credit. You can use some or your unified, you can use some of your unified credit to offset gift taxes during your lifetime, and the rest will be available to offset estate taxes at your death. By using some of your unified credit during your lifetime, you can lock in the current exemption amount, even if it's scheduled to decrease in the future. In summary, strategic lifetime giving or gifting can allow you to manage your estate taxes by utilizing the available exemption amount. The key benefit is removing future appreciation from your taxable estate by gifting earlier. This article is for informational purposes only, not intended as a replacement for real life advice. Consult your tax, legal, and accounting professionals before modifying your tax strategy and take advantage of some estate laws. So let's continue creating a spousal lifetime access trust or SLAT. It's interesting. A spousal lifetime access trust or SLAT is an irrevocable trust that you can create for your spouse and to which you can gift all or a portion of your estate tax lifetime exemption. Your spouse will have access to these assets during their lifetime since they will be the beneficiary. This grants you the benefit of removing assets from your taxable estate by using your federal estate tax exemption amount. If you do this in 2024, you can fund the trust up to $13.61 million. Waiting until 2026 may lower the allowable contribution. Spouses can also consider setting up dual SLATs, which are designated to benefit each other. There are downsides to SLATs, though, some of which may occur if you divorce or are predeceased by your spouse. It's important to remember that setting up a trust involves a complex set of tax rules and regulations. Before moving forward with the trust, we encourage clients to work with the professionals who are familiar with relevant rules and regulations and can offer guidance on various trust strategies. Establish an irrevocable life insurance trust. Life insurance proceeds generally aren't taxable. However, after you pass away, these proceeds could become part of your estate, which is subject to taxation. To help manage this, you can create an irrevocable life insurance trust. This involves setting up a trust and transferring its ownership to another person. Such a trust is irrevocable because in the future, you won't be able to adjust it without the consent of the trust's beneficiaries. Several factors affect the cost and availability of life insurance, including age and health, the type of amount of insurance purchased. Life insurance policies have expenses, including mortality and other charges. If a policy is surrendered prematurely, a policyholder may also incur surrender charges and face income tax implications. You should consider determining whether you're insurable before implementing a strategy involving life insurance. Any guarantees associated with a policy are dependent on the ability of the issuing insurance company to continue making claim payments. There's also setting up a charitable donation trust. You can also attempt to manage estate taxes by transferring part of your wealth to a charity through a trust. There are several types of trust strategies, but two of the more widely known strategies are charitable lead trusts and charitable remainder trusts. Each has its own characteristics, but generally by donating to a charity through a trust, you are looking to manage the value of your estate. Much like with a SLAT, transferring assets to a charity through a trust involves a complex set of tax rules and regs. Before moving forward, we encourage clients to work with professionals who can offer guidance, like a estate planning attorney, for example. Forming a family limited partnership. So you can set up a family limited partnership if you have a family-owned business or property you want your children to own after you're gone. To do this, one approach is to establish a general partnership and then make your heirs limited partners. You can be the general partner and still make all the business decisions. Each of your partners will have a stake in your company or will own a portion of your assets. This may help manage the size of your estate and any taxes to eventually be owed. This article is for informational purposes. It is not a replacement for real life advice on structuring a family limited partnership or any other trust for that matter. If this approach piques your interest, we encourage you to reach out to your legal, tax, and accounting professionals, as well as you can always call us to help kind of direct the discussion. Don't put off discussing your estate strategy. That is key. It's possible that changes to gift and estate tax exemptions will require more individuals and families to reconsider their estate strategies. If you want to explore opportunities, there are steps you can take over the next, say, 12 or 18 months. Even if exemptions revert to their previous lower levels, you can still take steps to manage your estate. As financial professionals, we are here to offer guidance on your estate and work with other professionals to create a estate strategy designed for your family. Please contact us if you have any questions or want to start discussing the topic before any rule changes. Always reach out to Northbound Wealth Management, 317-399-1107, 317-399-1107. And that'll do it for this episode of the Northbound Wealth Podcast. Stay tuned, and we're going to send out another one early next week, and we're going to get back on a more consistent schedule now that tax season is over. Thank God. Hope you have a great weekend. Give us a call if you ever need anything. Thank you.